have Iran today. The program presents the latest advances in science and technology in the Islamic Republic of Iran. It also highlights the latest business and economic developments in Iran. Stay with us for the next hour.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
A year ago today, the Israeli regime celebrated one of the most perverse acts of sabotage and terrorism the world has ever witnessed. Large-scale targeting of Lebanese civilians through pager and walkie-talkie explosions. Attacks that left at least 40 people dead and nearly 3,500 wounded. Israeli leadership claims Operation was a target Hezbollah resistance members, yet devices detonated anywhere and everywhere, from family dinner tables to crowded markets, shops, public transportation, parks, schools, and even an embassy. What the occupation called an achievement, the world saw as a reckless and shameful destructive act, along with the litany of other criminal acts that have defined the Zionist regime for over 75 years. The Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem today said Israel failed and continues to fail to take resistance fighters off the battlefield, and this is the focus of our Spotlight program. But first, here's a quick report.
Lebanon marks 1 year since a series of Israeli-coordinated explosions targeted Hezbollah's communication devices across the country. Thousands of pagers detonated simultaneously on September 17, 2024, followed by the explosion of numerous walkie-talkies the next day. Several countries slammed the attack as a terror attack, with the United Nations condemning it as a terrifying violation of international law, citing their indiscriminate nature. The two-day assault left at least 40 people dead and more than 3,400 injured, including children and civilians caught near the devices.
We even know that in war there is something called the ethics of war, but the enemy went beyond all of these things. He didn't think that the pager would be in the hands of children. We witnessed that there were many wounded children and women who had nothing to do with this matter.
Marking the anniversary, Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem delivered a televised address honoring the victims of the attacks as pioneers of insight and symbols of eternal devotion.
You are at the higher level and know that Israel will fall because its occupation, injustice, criminality and aggression, and because the resistance fighters are confronting it until liberation on the path to either of the two. And this is a permanent victory.
As Lebanon marks 1 year since the attack, the scars remain and so does the resolve. Despite the Lebanese government's U.S.-backed efforts to disarm Hezbollah movement, the resistance insists its weapons are not a threat to peace, but a shield against occupation and threats. Israel's continued strikes, even after a ceasefire agreement established in November 2024, prove that surrendering to the regime's demand will not bring security. From Gaza to Lebanon, the resistance sees itself not as a destabilizing force, but as the last line of defense for dignity, sovereignty, and survival.
And now for our guests. Joining us, Mr. Mohammed Qassem, academic and political analyst, joining us from Beirut. And Arnold August, author and journalist and contributing editor at Canada Files, joining us from Montreal. Hello, gentlemen. Pleasure to have you both on. I guess we'll start there in Beirut with you, Mr. Qassem. Good to have you join the program. Your first take on how you remember last year's pager attacks by the Israeli occupation entity in Lebanon.
I think that the Israelis had the intention of doing such an action
before, years ago, and they were preparing for this massacre against the Lebanese. But they did choose the special time to activate it, because Israel has many motives for doing such an action. The first of all, they had found that the resistance had been so powerful and were able to attack and support Gaza. That's why they wanted to cripple the resistance command control and the coordinating systems. This is one. The second motive that Israel wanted of this war is that they were trying to make a kind of psychological warfare by instilling fear and paranoia. And in this way, they would break the morale, and they make a kind of mistrust of the equipment that the resistance is using, and they are were trying also to reduce the operational efficiency of the resistance. Another motive of Israel was to deter against escalation. You know, at that time, the Lebanese resistance was ready to go forward and to proceed with the support of Gaza, but the escalation that the resistance was doing had a great effect on Israel. That's why the Israelis wanted to make a kind of deterrence against the escalation, especially with the rockets that the resistance were using, the missiles and other forms. Also, it was a kind of a message to Iran and to the region, and it is to show them that they are superior in technology as well as superior in intelligence. You know, it is also, to some extent, it is kind of a field test, infiltration, and they wanted to show that this action can be done. But another message that Israel was trying to do is a message for the internal situation of Israel. It is a kind of a domestic message for protests. You know, at that time, there were many protests, and the political divisions that were taking place at that time, and the criticism over the massacres that Israel was doing against Gaza. And this was also trying to calm the division inside Israel, and they wanted to tell them that we are making all our abilities to succeed in that. But
thank you.
Would that be enough for them, or was it a main reason for this escalation? I think that the 17th of September, which we consider as it is the war of pagers, and walkie-talkie on the second day. That's we call it here in Lebanon. It is the anniversary of the recovery. Mm. Our slogan today is that we recovered. This is what the injured had said all
Thank
over
you.
The country. And this
Mr.
slogan
Kossum,
had been proven during
Kossum.
The demonstration. During the demonstration
Mr.
that
August
was made.
Mr. Kossum, please, we don't have much time. I want to have both of you speak. Mr. Arnold, August, thank you for your patience, sir. Good to have you on the program.
It's a pleasure.
If you remember, this time last year, after this attack, Israeli leadership, they laughed, they danced, they paraded around as if they pulled off, the most genius operation of the century. Many saw the very exact opposite. How did you see it?
Well, I think what you're saying and the previous speaker saying, the main goal, I think, was while U.S. and Israel were losing the war in Gaza as well as in Lebanon, that specific attack was aimed to try to show once again the superiority of the U.S.-Israeli war machine being used to carry out the Holocaust. And of course, what they not only they did it, you saw it dancing in the streets, but it also had wide diplomatic implications when various representatives of Israel visited other countries, for example, in Washington, D.C. On live camera, they made jokes. How about if you? How would you like to have a pager on you? I mean, there are many examples how they actually made jokes of the slaughter that took place against the Lebanese people by the U.S.-backed Israeli armed forces. But I think 1 year later, did they succeed in intimidating the resistance movement? No. Did they succeed in stifling the opposition within Israel, even though it is limited to Netanyahu? No, it has actually increased. The resistance has increased, and the opposition within Israel by the so-called, you know, liberal wing of Zionism has also increased. And despite its limitations, it acts as a very important stop or a way to hold Netanyahu accountable, even though we're not seeing. Resistance has definitely increased, and so has the opposition within Israel increased as well. Israel, in fact, is falling apart at the seams. We have to be patient. I am sure in the coming weeks and months, it eventually is going to fall apart because of the economic problems, the contradiction within Zionism, and the opposition to the U.S. Zionist attack against the Palestinian people. It does not go down well at all with the Israeli population, even though they had that spectacular success in Lebanon a year ago with those pagers.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mr. Qasem, if any other government or regime on this planet was to carry out a similar reckless act like this, where civilians are in the direct line of fire and in imminent danger, the tag of state sponsor of terrorism would be put upon them, followed by sanctions and repercussions. Leadership would be held to account. But with this regime, we see a prime minister running around the world, giving, I'm sure you've seen, golden pagers to Western politicians as mementos to celebrate this brazen act of terrorism. Your thoughts on the double standards when it comes to the Israeli regime?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear well. The line is not functioning well. But what did I understand of what your question is? The government's reaction to this war of pagers. This is if it is like that, I would say that unfortunately our government was not in that suitable position. The negligence and not any effort was done by the government and by the official institutions in Lebanon to face such a catastrophe when we have not less than 20 dead people, martyrs, and about 3,000 wounded, and they were left open to the initiatives of people, initiatives of some social workers or some doctors who had been volunteers to do the job. That's why they were left for their environment or for their society. And unfortunately, the wounded, they had very big and very critical time with no one to help, except some initiatives done by some social organizations or local organizations that the people did. That's why when we see that we have injuries, wounded in their eyes, in their hands, in their abdomens, in their lungs, in their waist, all these, they needed special care. They needed medical operations and so on. It took a long time to be adjusted to that, and it is good that we have the institutions related to the resistance that was also supporting with some other organizations that they did. But here we can say that we are praising the initiatives of the doctors, of the nurses, of the working of health care and so on, and their reaction to this. And this was so good that it helped in making the loss less. Mm. That's why they were with no equipments, no surgical equipments, and so on. But it passed, and now by 1 year, we can see that these wounded people are now completely different persons. They are militants. They are proud of themselves. We will talk about that, I think, in the other question. But we are so proud of these people who were wounded, and they are around 3,000. Their demonstration today was so great that they were walking proudly. They were saying that, okay, we have lost our eyes or hands or fingers or ribs or and so on, but we rehabilitated ourselves. We are now adjusting to our situations. Some of them are now working. Some of them did marry. Others were studying in the universities. Some others are working as social workers and in different fields. And they had been changed, or they are completely changed from one person to another. They are more active in the society now. And they said that we have lost some of our parts, but we are more involved in our country's problems and issues, and we should proceed in our track of resistance. They are now proving that they are a new resistance people who are able to face all the obstacles of life in a very self-confident situation.
Thank you, sir. And
I would like to say that
can I ask Mr.
It is a
August.
Kind of another form of
thank you. Let me just say, Mr. Arnold August, so when we put last year's pager attacks and then the war that followed, and you put it next to the ceasefire in November 27th and the thousands upon thousands of ceasefire violations, the continued occupation by Israel of Lebanese soil up until this very day, how do you find the pretext or the justification to speak of disarming Hezbollah in Lebanon or the Amal or any a resistance faction in the region when you realize who you're up against?
Yes, you're absolutely right. It's complete double standard. They, you know, brazenly talk about disarming Hamas, talking about recognizing a new Palestinian state, but without Hamas. In other words, give up your arms, they are saying to Hamas. And what does that mean in real terms? Just to facilitate the Holocaust that has been going on in recent times since October 7, 2023, and as well as from the beginning, from 1948. You asked whether any other countries have carried out such a brazen attack against individual citizens, as was carried out by Israel with the pager attacks. From as far as I know, no. I don't think there's been anything like it. However, we have to ask the following question. Is the guilty party only Netanyahu, a wild card Netanyahu? I think it would be wrong for us to think that the problem in the Middle East is Netanyahu. The problem in the Middle East is U.S. full unconditional support for Israel, including, for example, the pager attack that took place, on all of the other attacks that took place, for example, against Iran, against the Palestinian people. Like right now as we speak, they're also occupying and arresting people in the occupied bank, trying to take over Gaza City. This is the reality of the situation. The pager incident is just part of U.S.-Israeli policy in the United States to eliminate the Palestinian people. Yes.
And the U.S. today is pushing the Ayoun government to basically try to disarm Hezbollah in Lebanon.
That's terrible. I mean, I'm sure the Lebanese people, knowing personally from people who live there, militants, intellectuals, etc., including who you're on TV today, there's no way the Lebanese people will give up their arms because the United States and Israel wants them to give up arms. On the contrary, what is happening and what is going to happen is that the Lebanese people will rise once again. Just as George Abbas, after spending all those years in prison, he came back undefeated in Beirut as a hero because he stands up for the Palestinian people. This is Lebanon. They will not give up arms. They will keep on fighting against the United States and Israel.
And I really want to put that same question to Mr. Mohammad Qasem. Mr. Mohammad Qasem, this case that the U.S. is trying to make and give these guarantees, it knows it cannot give to Beirut to disarm Hezbollah. When you look at Israel's track record over the last 40 years in Lebanon, over the last 75 years in Palestine, how do you justify disarming the resistance?
I think that the Lebanese government and especially the prime minister is doing a very fatal action, and the ministry, the whole ministry, had taken a very dramatic as well as a very dangerous decision that they are trying, or they are working on disarming the resistance as well as disarming the Palestinians. What we know of this, there are many motives for that. The disarming means what? It is, first of all, they are trying to break down all the power that the Lebanese had gained for years and years and had paid for that, thousands of martyrs, as well as suffering and troubles all over years, economically, socially, security, and so on. This minister now, or the prime minister, who is insisting and trying to pull the legs of all the cabinet or the ministers in order to force this kind of disarmament. The disarmament means that they wanted us to be open to the enemy. And this is according to what Trump says or orders, and why, and this is what Ortegas as well as Barack had planned and are trying to do that. If we take a kind of statistics or a kind of asking a poll within the Lebanese, there was a very neutral poll was done by more than one institution. It proved that there are still, even with these casualties and destruction and occupying of five villages, and still the Israelis are in the south, there are more than 60 to 65% of the Lebanese population who refuse or who asks the resistance not to give their arms to the government, and they said that we are still feeling, or we are in need of this weapon to face the cruelty and the massacres that Israel had done. While I'm talking to you now, a kind of air raid had been made against Baalbek, which is so far more than 200 to 300 kilometers from the borders to the north of Lebanon, and they had killed more than one martyr. This is I don't know what the prime minister wants on insisting of disarming or taking the army of the resistance. It means one thing to a logical person which says that why you signed for a treaty where the first item of this is the withdrawal of the enemy, leaving the villages that had been occupied, releasing the hostages, rebuilding the destroyed or the destructed houses, and then we discuss the disarming, or at least to a strategic policy of Lebanon, especially according to the defense strategy.
Why are you insisting only on
disarming the resistance? It means he is under the orders of the United States and Israel as well.
Thank you, both of you, sincerely for joining us on the program. It's a pleasure to have you both on. Mr. Mohammed Qasem, they're joining us from Beirut, and also Mr. Arnold August joining us from Montreal. It brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
Here's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite, Back to Reality. Yes, once more we are here to bring you back to another reality, which is the concern of today's world, I guess, and it's very prevailing everywhere. And I hope wherever you are, you're doing well and everything is just going so fine with you. So welcome to this episode. This is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be with you. And with me, I have two very dear guests, Brother Liaqat and Brother Muhammad. Welcome both of you to the studio and assalamu alaikum.
Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum assalam.
So, well, I know you already know how the ritual of this program goes. I would like you to give us a very brief introduction about yourself and about your background. What have you been doing all these years? So, let's start with Brother Liaqat.
Muhammad Liaqat Abbas from India, and I've done my bachelor's in history of Islam, and right now I'm doing my master's in psychology.
Very good. And you?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My name is Muhammad, and I have studied a lot about the Quran and Islamic studies. While my university degrees are not related to this, I have a bachelor's in English literature and also English language teaching, master's in English language teaching. But I'm mostly interested in topics related to the Quran, especially, and also a hadith and anything Islamic. And I've done a lot of research in this field.
So I guess we have a perfect combination in here, psychology and Islamic research, which is going to help us too much to bring things into reality and into the spotlight of reality. Well, is marriage about the clock ticking or no? The hearts must be engaged. Or do we have such a concept like there is a perfect age for marriage? And if you're past that age, then marriage is over for you.
No, we don't have any perfect age for marriage, just like you have asked. And whenever the person is ready for marriage, and of course the maturity matters, like the body which matures, number one, financial maturity, intellectual maturity.
That's the most important, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. So when these things are satisfied, when these maturities have been attained by a person, example, that is when the person is ready. And the person should have the will to get married as well. Like, okay, I'm ready for marriage. I want to get married. I can live a life, a married life, and I can lead it peacefully and successfully. Everything should be there. And that is when the person, yeah, can get married. And so according to me, there's no perfect age.
So, you know, there was a time in which we used to think that in specific places for specific nations, like there is a specific age for marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Now the world has changed and there are many people who might think that, okay, let's get at the very first square. Why do we have to get married?
Before answering that question, we have to first finish the talk about the, whether age is important or not. Okay, it's not biological age. You've heard the saying, age is just a number. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That a person could be 18 years old, but still be like at a really high intellectual level as like a 30-year-old person, or the other way around. A 30-year-old person might not be
mature
as like a 19-year-old person. I don't know. So maturity is important, emotional, spiritual, financial. But you see, when we read the Quran and the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt and the Prophet, peace be upon his progeny, physical maturity is probably the top priority for marriage, because the philosophy of marriage, according to the Quran, is to, you know, avoid sin, right?
Mm-hmm.
To stop young people from committing sins,
yeah,
like really bad sins, like major sins. So once a young person feels that need, and that need is really strong, that it's almost uncontrollable, that person should do something for their marriage, whether it's a man or a woman. They have the physical maturity. They have to, you know, acquire the emotional and spiritual maturity to become a husband or wife. So in order for a marriage to happen, first of all, it's not age. A person might feel that need when they're 18 or when they're 30. Okay?
Yeah.
So whenever they have that need, they have to do something about it. If they don't have like a job, they should start.
Okay, there are many youngsters who have the need, but
money.
They don't have the intellectual
maturity.
Well,
they have to make the effort to, you know, make sure that the preliminaries are provided for that person's marriage, for their own marriage, actually. So,
but then I guess that would be a little bit problematic, because marriage based on physical
if they
need,
can get married, this is what Islam says, if they really can get married, then they have to have taqwa and avoid sin as much as they can until, this is the verse of the Quran, until Allah, he bestows his grace on that person and that person is able to get married.
Yeah. So it's time.
And by the way, you know, this is a really bad mentality that we have nowadays. It's not just one person who has to do everything for their own marriage. The others, the parents of that person, they have to help that person get married.
Yeah, but
this is a culture that we Muslims have.
Just before getting into marriage, for that individual, I guess there are some requirements for that person to get married, not just the physical need. We go for a break.
No, I did say the requirements, the financial, the spiritual, the emotional.
Intellectual. Yeah, that's very important. So let's go for a break and then we come back to see what is coming out of this discussion.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Imagine, like, there are many youngsters out there that you would see right now in today's world as they're affected by, you know, media is not helping them, actually. So this need is much more like an eruption of emotions. So do they have to marry whenever they feel the need?
No. Actually, the thing is, if they are not ready intellectually, Islam doesn't force them to get married. Yep. Of course, according to Ahkam, thing is, it becomes obligatory upon the person to get married. Why does it become obligatory upon a person to get married? From one perspective, okay? From one perspective is because he's sinning, he or she, okay? From this angle. And if that sinning purpose, example, the purpose of sinning is deviated, example, then, and the person doesn't sin, yeah? Then the purpose of getting married later on gets satisfied, meaning the person should get married later on. Why? Because he's not intellectually ready. He's not financially ready. Number two, Islam talks about a lot of societal-based ahkam as well. Like, example, you cannot ruin the opposite person's life.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
When you're ready, that when you are, when you know that you're gonna, if you get married, you're gonna ruin up the opposite person's life. You don't have any financial stability. You don't have a place to stay. You don't have any place to keep your wife. Example, if it's a, it's a, if it's a male, he cannot keep his wife. He cannot provide his wife.
No, forget about that. He cannot understand her.
Definitely. Then, of course, it's highly not applicable for this person to enter marriage. Yeah. So Islam is not like, okay, you know what? This one thing satisfies. So go ahead. Example. There's a reason a person needs to consult before getting married. Mm-hmm. Before getting married, the person should see a consultant, someone, a scholar, Islamic scholar, who knows, like if. And who can guide the person, be it a male or a female, I don't mind. Who can guide the person. Okay, are you ready? Spiritually is one thing. Are you ready physically, intellectually, financially, and emotionally, everything? If your spouse feels low emotionally, can you provide her or him, example, emotional support? If you are not having much to provide your spouse, then are you really financially stable? Example, what about intellectual stability, you see? Of course, we are talking
because as we talk about this age...
I think Yavad is saying he's being a little too strict, that you have to see a consultant to see whether you are right. You know, that's not really applicable, in my opinion. You yourself have to feel ready. If you are confident that you're ready for marriage and you have the financial requirement, you have the intellectual requirement... You are, you know, like you have all the prerequisites, right? You could get married.
Okay, you know what? The thing is.
And you should strive for attaining those things, those requirements of marriage.
But at the age of 18, for example.
And
yes, people are different. And the number of people that I see and I have seen in the course of my life, and they married at a very young age, most often they are very much regretful about why they got married so soon.
You know, because my stream is psychology itself.
Yeah, but we also have the other way around.
Well,
people are regretful why they got married so late.
Yeah, we have that, but I don't know why, but I have this mentality that those are exceptions, and exceptions do not break the rules.
Definitely. You know, because my stream
maturity
is psychology.
I guess the key is maturity.
Intellectual maturity
is very
that's
important.
What we're
just like
about,
the brother has stated even over here, like he should feel himself that he is ready. But, you know, sometimes this even doesn't work. Why? Because, of course, from a psychological perspective, because my
Since
studies
you are
is
an
in
expert
psychology,
in psychology.
And, alhamdulillah, many people have consulted as well with this regards. And I have seen, unfortunately, at a lot of places, I myself was in place like giving consultation to the participants, or I would say individuals who would come near me, and I have seen people who told themselves that they are ready and have entered marriage, and they got married, and after a few months the marriage got broke, like it went up till divorce, and they got divorced because they were not good with intellectual stability, like they were not intellectually matured. Though they were thinking that they are completely ready, yeah. So this thing happens. That's the reason I brought this concept of consultation. Example, if they
so the consultant was saying that they're not ready, and they
I would say according to me, he was not ready, but still he was like, I'm ready for sure. Like I know about myself. I have money. I have I have financial stability. I know that I can get married, and I can provide my wife a house and everything, whatever she wants. And after they got married, there were a number of issues, like a lot. The wife would cry day and night, like no other day, unfortunately. I don't want to go into details. Mm-hmm. I've seen these kind of cases a lot. Like the brother Muhammad's brother example, his case is exceptional, just like over here.
I do.
But you have
so.
But there are people who would say, I'm ready. Example, myself, okay? When I was at the age of 18, I would say 19, near about 19, I thought that I'm ready. And I went to see a scholar, and I was like, okay, can I get married now? Because I think I'm ready. I can provide, for my family. He was like, no, you're not ready. You're thinking that you're ready, but you're wrong. And later on, after a year or two, I asked him the reason.
So according to him, what you were lacking?
Sorry?
And according to that scholar, what was your lack?
Okay, just in one short word, my intellect maturity. The maturity of my intellect, okay? At the age of 22, when I went to him every year, I would go near him and I would tell him my ideologies, my beliefs, everything. Like, I would sit with him properly for an hour. And he's a very good scholar, by the way. And he would analyze everything. He would say, no, you're not ready. I would be like, oh, what's lagging in me? And at the age of 22, he heard and he asked me questions, a lot of questions. And now you're ready.
Age of 22.
22. At the age of 20, I got married. Alhamdulillah, it worked well for me.
So, you know, I guess it's not the matter of a specific age, mm-hmm. as much as it is the matter of the framework of your mentality. Kindness even to forget about ourselves and even think about others. So this becomes an important matter in marriage. Like, there are some other factors as well. So this maturity is the thing that would actually decide for you, for marriage, I guess. And wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, ya Rabb al-alamin, ya Rahman, ya Rahim, ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again. Ya Allah, ya Rabb al-alamin, ya Rahman, ya Rahim, ya Let the ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again. Something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. I wish that somehow you tell me sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong. I know I'm waiting. tell me of a love that on that day you forgive me. But we'll never know, 'cause that's not the way it was. I beg for your mercy, my Lord, show me. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong, my Lord. Show me right from wrong. Give me light. Make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Isfahan has long been a city of superlatives, once the dazzling capital of the Persian Empire. It has been praised in poetry, painted in manuscripts, and remembered by travelers as one of the most beautiful cities in the world. Its domes shimmer with turquoise and gold, its boulevards stretch beneath ancient plane trees, and its squares still thrum with the life of centuries past. For Iranians, Isfahan is not just a city, it is memory, identity, and pride. For visitors, it is a journey through time, a place where beauty is not hidden in museums, but lived in the streets. They call it Nisfe Jahan, which means half of the world, and here in Naqsh-e Jahan Square, you can see why. Once the heart of the Safavid Empire, this is where life, art, and history come together in one breathtaking panorama. Welcome to Isfahan, an ancient city that still captures the hearts of travelers from all around the world. Isfahan is Iran's third largest city, just 435 kilometers south of Tehran. But unlike the political capital, Isfahan has always been the spiritual and cultural heart of the country. From the 16th century, when Shah Abbas made it the capital of his empire, the city became a showcase of Persian brilliance, a center of science, trade, art, and architecture that drew visitors from Venice, Delhi, and even Beijing. Our introduction to Isfahan began with a meeting with Mr. Mehdi Jamalinejad, governor of the province. He painted a vivid picture of Isfahan's unique character, highlighting its blend of ancient heritage and modern achievements, from world-famous monuments to a state-of-the-art healthcare hub.
The province of Isfahan is one of the largest in Iran, with more than 114 cities, over 1,000 villages, and more than 22,000 historical sites. Its tangible and intangible heritage is truly unparalleled. Just recently, we lost the great master painter Mahmud Farshtian, who was one of many symbolic figures rooted in this land. When the new administration came into office last year, we defined three main axes for development in Isfahan. The first of these, and one of the most important, is tourism. Our aim is to transform the province's enormous potential into real, active opportunities. Most foreign visitors know Isfahan only for its history and monuments, but our province also has extraordinary natural attractions, especially protected areas like Muteh, Qamishlu, and Kolah Qazi, which are ideal for ecotourism. Beyond cultural and historical tourism, we are also working on religious tourism, health tourism, and more. Isfahan Healthcare City is unique in Iran, and it already attracts visitors from abroad. Some of the doctors based there are internationally renowned.
Naqsh Jahan Square itself is a city within a city. Flanked by the Imam Mosque, the Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, the Ali Ghafur Palace, and the great Qaisariyye Bazaar, it is both a UNESCO World Heritage Site and one of the largest squares in the world. It is here that you understand why Isfahan has always been seen as a living museum of Persian civilization. Mr. Governor stressed that Isfahan's allure cannot be attributed to just one reason, but to a rich combination of elements.
Isfahan's uniqueness also lies in its biodiversity. Certain species of wildlife and fish exist here and nowhere else in the world. This, too, is an attraction for visitors interested in nature. On a global level, Isfahan is twinned with major cities like Barcelona and St. Petersburg and is a member of many international networks, from UNESCO-created cities to organizations of historic capitals. This reflects Isfahan's global reputation, which is not new but centuries old. Travelers in past centuries described it as one of the most flourishing cities in the world.
Every tile here tells a story of patience, devotion, and a love for beauty that defines Persian architecture. Isfahan's mosques aren't just monuments, they're living museums of color, geometry, and light. This artistry isn't locked in the past. It continues to inspire architects and visitors alike, making Isfahan a treasure for those who come seeking meaning and beauty. Beyond the mosques and palaces, the city's cultural richness is unmatched. Siyosepol and Khaju Bridge stretch across what was once the mighty Zayanda River, creating gathering places that are still alive today. The Chehel Sutun Palace dazzles with mirrored columns that reflect history as vividly as the day they were built. And in Julfa, the Armenian quarter, cobblestone streets lead to Vank Cathedral, a reminder that Isfahan was always a crossroads of faiths and cultures. Conversations continued with Mr. Amir Karamzadeh, Director General of Isfahan's Cultural Heritage, Tourism, and Handicrafts Organization. He emphasized that despite its fame, much of the province's tourism potential has yet to be realized.
ما در اصفهان زیبا خیلی خیلی میتونیم بیشتر رو حوزه گردشگری تمرکز کنیم. ما
Isfahan truly deserves much more focus on tourism. We believe that if tourism thrives here, it will benefit the whole country because visitors who come to Isfahan often go on to explore other parts of Iran. Handicrafts play a complementary role in this. Isfahan is home to one-third of the world's handicraft disciplines. You could fairly call it the handicrafts capital of the world. This is thanks to our rich heritage and the outstanding artists who have worked here. One example is the late Master Mahmoud Farshchian, an internationally renowned painter of miniatures, who was from Isfahan. The city is also the resting place of many great mystics and spiritual figures. For instance, Taht-e Fulat, our historic cemetery, has significant potential for religious tourism.
Into Isfahan's bazaar and you step into centuries of tradition. Here the artisans craft minakari enamel, weave Persian carpets, and carve intricate marquetry, which are all skills passed through generations. This isn't just shopping, it's conversation with history, and where every purchase is a piece of Persian culture that you can take home.
Another distinction is that Isfahan is a UNESCO creative city for handicrafts, one of very few worldwide. More than three-quarters of Iran's handicraft disciplines are concentrated here. In some villages, every single household is a small workshop. Entire families produce crafts together. Handicrafts here are not hobbies, but livelihoods, deeply tied to culture and community. This is part of what makes them so attractive to visitors.
Handicrafts aren't just souvenirs here. They are part of the city's economic engine. Isfahan produces nearly a third of Iran's handicrafts exports, and its artisans are world-renowned. Another highlight of our visit was a conversation with Mr. Mohammad Natiqpour, president of the Isfahan Association of Handicrafts Exporters and Producers.
Isfahan, پایتخت ایران از نظر صنایع دستی.
Isfahan is Iran's capital of handicrafts, and globally it rivals countries like China and India. About one-third of the world's handicrafts are produced in Isfahan, while Iran as a whole boasts around 400 artistic disciplines.
For investors, the potential is enormous. Cultural branding, artisan villages, and international exhibitions could transform these crafts into premium global brands. Himself a celebrated marquetry master for more than 60 years, Mr. Natiqpour shared how Isfahani artisans have contributed to the city's attraction.
Most of these art forms are also major tourist attractions. For example, khatamkari or marquetry, the most intricate and technical handicraft, is followed by metal engraving, wood inlay, carpet weaving, and others. Their colors and designs appeal differently across the markets. Carpets and larger works are popular in Europe and America, while neighboring countries often prefer smaller pieces. In short, the whole city of Isfahan can be considered a living museum of handicrafts with world-class masters working here.
In Natiqpour's words, art is immune from the blades of sanctions and therefore represents a resilient and attractive sector for investment in Iran.
We face no real barriers to exports, even under sanctions. Neighboring countries such as Qatar, Oman, and UAE are key markets, as are Russia and China. We understand these markets' preferences and can successfully export to them.
Tourism already contributes close to 10% of Iran's GDP, and Isfahan is at its core. The province boasts more than 20,000 historical sites, over 60% of them concentrated right here in the city. But while millions of domestic visitors and thousands of foreign tourists arrive each year, the city still lacks the infrastructure to host them comfortably. Our visit took us to the Piruzi Hotel, where we met its manager, Mr. Amir Masoud Labbafan.
Isfahan is known worldwide as a museum city. Hotel service